Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the Ultrasound Gel Podcast. We're so glad you're here. I'm Mike Pratz, and I'm joined today by the wonderful Jacob Avila and Cray Bolger.
I want to be wonderful, too.
Well, I meant the collectively wonderful.
Yeah, and then both of us together.
I know. Yeah. We make a whole human.
Yeah, that's fine. Next time, can you call me pretty?
Pretty? No, I can't. I can't do that. All right, so today's paper is titled Predictive Value of Tracheal Rapid Ultrasound Exam Performed in the Emergency Department for Verification of Tracheal Intubation. This was published in an open access journal in Macedonia.
Okay.
Just a little warning there. So this paper we wanted to talk about because this is something that a lot of people like to think about in the ultrasound world now. Can you use ultrasound of the airway to confirm your endotracheal tubes? We all know that sometimes it's hard, especially when you're learning to intubate people, to figure out is that tube in the esophagus or is it in the trachea. There's a lot of different ways that you can confirm whether the endotracheal tube is in the trachea instead of the esophagus. You know, you can obviously auscultate the lungs. Hopefully you'll have bilateral lung sounds that are the same, or you can use end-tidal carbon dioxide monitoring, which can be either quantitative or qualitative, chest x-ray, and multiple other ways. The main advantage that ultrasound would hold over these other ways is that it's faster. You can actually visualize the balloon passing through the trachea or the esophagus while it's happening, and thereby being able to say, yep, it's in, let's start using it right away. And some papers even take a look to see, is there bilateral symmetric lung sliding that can tell you, hey, it's actually in the trachea and not in one of the main stems. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot you can do with ultrasound. So let's see how they tackled it in this paper.
Cool. So what they did was it's kind of interesting. I don't know if you guys found this as interesting as I did. So they started I found it fascinating. So they started out with 154 patients that were evaluated that needed emergent intubation, and they excluded 54 patients due to some people had neck tumors, neck trauma, previous trachs, or they were unable to have the ultrasound or capnography at the bedside. Capnography was the gold standard, by the way. So what they did was they had somebody intubate, and while there was intubation, they had a sheet put in between the neck and the mouth, and then they had the guy ultrasounding actually wear earplugs to not have any like bias as to where it was at.
I thought that was like the best part of their methods. Like they really went all out.
Yeah, they
did. You picture just being in a room with earplugs in? There's a sheet all around you. Yeah. You have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, it's like sensory deprivation.
Patient is critically ill.
Yeah.
And the patient wakes up and grabs you.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
So they did this after the fact. So what they did was they intubated. The intubator said, I'm in the trachea. And then while they were getting kind of the capnography, the ultrasonographer was ultrasounding at the suprasternal notch, basically just looking for the presence of a tracheal versus esophageal intubation. And they define the tracheal intubation as seeing a hypoechoic ring. Sorry, hypoechoic tube with some comatail artifacts, which is how we describe it in the trachea, not seeing the two tracheas or the two air mucosal surfaces, which would be present in an esophageal intubation. Now, one thing here, two things actually. The first thing is that they did this not in real time, which personally, I think it's easier to do it in real time than to do it after the fact. And the other thing was that they a little bit had their nomenclature wrong. There is such thing as a direct and indirect method of confirming. What they thought was direct was when you scan the whole neck, and indirect is just placing the probe in the suprasternal notch. But actually, indirect is when you look at other things like the diaphragm and the lung, and then direct is when you look directly at the trachea. So a little bit wrong in their nomenclature, but that's perfectly fine because they described it. So they ended up with 100 patients that were enrolled and that they were able to have after all their exclusions. And they found some stuff that is fairly consistent with the literature.
Of these 100 patients, they had a 94% success rate for tracheal intubation. 6% of their patients had esophageal intubation. And they found out that the TRUE study, which again was a little unclear how they did it, And I found it interesting that they were using the curvilinear probe.
Yeah, that's weird. Although I have been actually using the curvilinear probe. I don't know if ours is better, but I have been using mostly the curvilinear probe, just kind of zoomed in. And sometimes it's a little easier to see the esophagus and the trachea in the same view compared to
the linear.
You
know what I want is a reversed curve probe that like sits on the trachea.
Whoa.
Money maker.
You can make a step-off pad that, that fits over
I
the
wanted
neck.
To just like hug the trachea.
I love it.
A snuggle.
A tracheal hug.
All right, sorry. I digress.
Okay. So what they found was a pretty good sensitivity and specificity, 98% sensitive and 100% specific, with an accuracy of 99%.
Pretty good.
These are kind of mind-blowing numbers that we really don't see very often in our studies. Maybe it was due to their amazing blinding of their...
And deafening.
Literally blinding.
Blinding and deafening.
Reviewers. So only one of their ultrasound exams disagreed with the capnography. Where the true exam interpreted as esophageal, but it was actually tracheal. All the positives were true positives, so that was a good thing. Now, the limitations of this was it was a convenient sample. They didn't have a lot of esophageal intubations, which for their patients is a good thing, and probably honestly fits with more realistic numbers to what we would see clinically. Again, their methods were a bit unclear. You have to refer to other studies to get an idea of how they did it. Again, the curvilinear versus the linear probe may be a little bit of a change from what most people would consider standard. And we're unsure if it was a single provider who was performing the ultrasound exams, so this may not be reproducible in the masses. I think those are the big kind of take-home points. So performed pretty well, unsure how much training and how much experience is necessary to get those numbers. And again, the sample population didn't have a lot of negatives, so it'd be interesting to see this expanded with maybe more challenging patient population, since it seems like they took all the challenging ones and kind of took them out. Mm-hmm. You know, the place where I can see this being really applicable, putting on a different hat of mine, is EMS world, where you can't hear anything, especially if you're in a post-arrest where your end tidal may not be super helpful. How do you confirm a tube? You know, that's the worst case scenario, is they got transported 45 minutes with their esophagus being bagged.
Right.
In somebody who is potentially survivable. So that's where I see this being applicable, but that would be a much wider user base who probably will have less experience in training. And it's going to be those challenging airways. It's not going to be the ones where you've selected out the good people.
That's a really good point. I think they chose their exclusion criteria probably because it would be difficult to do the ultrasound of the neck in those people with all those neck pathologies. But you're totally right that those people also are going to be more prone to have difficult airways.
Right.
So there's a lot of bias in the population that they studied. And I like how you brought in the EMS, because one of my questions about this article was, why would you do this? You know, here we are all ultrasound lovers, and we are all for using ultrasound in new ways, but we also like to be practical about it. Why do we need this intervention over what we currently do? What's wrong with using end-tidal CO2 or those other methods? Are we trying to save time? Are we trying to save money? I think that EMS is a great example of where it could be used, because they don't have a lot of other options. And at the bedside in the emergency department where we all work, I think it can definitely give you a lot faster answers than a chest x-ray, but I think we're still all going to probably keep using end-tidal CO2 to confirm it right away. We're probably going to keep listening to their lungs.
I think maybe in the peri-arrest situation where you can't get a chest x-ray and you want to make sure your tube's not the reason why you're not getting ROSC.
One thing that I kind of mentioned it before, I do this in real time. Like, I have a rag in one hand and the curvilinear, the linear probe in the other hand. And while the resident's intubating, I'm placing my probe like on the lateral side of the neck while they're intubating a little higher up. So I can see before bagging where, you know, if it's in the trachea or if it's in the esophagus. And that is how I use it clinically, is basically to get end-tidal CO2, you have to bag. And sometimes, you know, if you're in the esophagus, it'll take like 3, maybe 4 bags sometimes before you're like, oh, that slight color change or that slight little bump in the CO2 is actually coming from the stomach. But at that point, you've already bagged the stomach a little bit, and that's probably bad. So that's how I use it clinically. But I think that it would probably be most useful in the, you know, EMS world. I agree.
I think one other kind of interesting use of it is identifying anatomical differences in people. So how high is their vocal cords? Where is their esophagus relevant to their vocal cords? So that's not something they discussed in this, but when I'm teaching it, that's what I like to point out to the residents. Like, when in doubt, aim right, usually. But for some of our patients who may have a mass, or you can take a look and see what you're getting into before you put them down and take, you know. So I think this could be used to kind of adjunct maybe even the Mallampati and the Lemon Law and all the things that we use to predict difficult airways, is taking a look, seeing which blade you need to pick before you get it in there and before you're wasting valuable oxygenation and time.
That's a great point. Yeah, I use it similarly to you, Jacob, where you have someone else doing the intubation, because keep in mind, it's pretty tricky to do this by yourself if you're the one intubating. I wouldn't recommend that. So if someone else is intubating and you're just sitting at the bedside twiddling your thumbs or saying, what do you see, what do you see, what do you see, this could be something instead where you can actually see. And if they put in the tube and you see that esophagus light up, you just tell them to pull it out right away, because you don't want to waste time bagging that and any repercussions of that. So I like it for that reason too. It can save you a little bit of time. We know that any sort of delays in getting the airway can be potentially problematic for your patient. So it's a little bit faster feedback, and if it's not much expense, then it's probably worthwhile. Honestly, the main reason why I don't do this is the lack of space sometimes. You know, when you're intubating people, there's about 50 people in a room, and so to wheel in an ultrasound machine at the same time, kind of have to knock some people around to get it in there.
I swear, I think a handheld would be super useful. It'll also keep me out of the resident's hair if they're not using video laryngoscopy, as I can feel better and they can feel better that I'm not on their back.
Yeah, and remember that there's other ways that you can do this. Some of the anesthesia literature on point-of-care ultrasound for this has used looking at tracheal widening and also lung sliding, where you're looking for symmetric lung sliding.
The tracheal widening is just with the cuff insufflation, not with the intubation itself.
Exactly, yeah. So they're looking, those are studies where I think they're looking for, is it in the right place rather than is it in the right place in the trachea,
right,
rather than is it in the trachea versus the esophagus.
Right.
I think they also use that for mainstem to pick the level it's at. So you look for the widening below the cords but above the sternal notch to make sure you're not mainstem. So again, much more useful in pre-hospital where they can't see if they're bagging one lung or the other, and when they don't have any other modality to confirm placement. So maybe they have breath sounds, but they've mainstemmed the patient, which for some of our patients could be detrimental. You know, many can tolerate it, but not all.
Great. So let me just summarize this study then. This was a prospectively done study where the sonologist was blinded and deafened, and he performed a tracheal rapid ultrasound exam, which they called the TRUE exam. And what they found with their 154 patients was that there was a sensitivity of 98.9% and a specificity of 100%. So my take-home points from this article is that, yes, tracheal ultrasound to confirm an endotracheal tube intubation can be sensitive and specific, but I think we need some more research to determine the best method to do this and how to exactly incorporate it into our practice so that there's some patient-centered outcomes associated with it. Thanks to the authors for doing this cool study, and thanks for listening. Remember, you can check out our website, ultrasoundgel.org, sign up for our mailing list there so you don't miss any episodes, and check us out on Twitter, Google+, or Facebook as well. We look forward to hearing from you there, and we'll talk to you later.
More pressure, more gel, more pressure, more gel.
Ultrasound Gel Podcast. I'm sorry, take that part out. I'm sorry. And it's inappropriate, so I'm sorry.